Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the second crash of the new Boeing 737 MAX 8, which has advanced software known as MAX, Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, an anti-stall protection where sensors detect the plane's AOA angle of attack, leading to a possible stall, forcing the autopilot to intervene and push the plane's nose down. This series of events apparently caused the recent crash of the Lion Air 737 MAX 8 in Indonesia, which killed 189 people, and might be the cause of Sunday's Ethiopian Airlines crash that killed 157. James Fellows, an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic, joins us to discuss his latest article at The Atlantic, Is It Time to Worry About the Boeing 737 MAX 8? No one knows for sure, but here's where experts will be looking for clues. With 4,761 orders for the plane, Boeing must now have concerns about cancellations, and of the 350 737 MAX 8 aircraft in operation worldwide flown by 54 airlines, a few carriers have grounded their fleets, while most are flying the aircraft and are confident in its safety. Insufficient training to override MAX software may have caused the crashes, but if it's a case of software and automation in conflict with human control, then the bigger issue of reliance on robotics and autonomous vehicles comes into play. Then we'll speak with one of the country's leading experts on sentencing policy, race, and the criminal justice system, Mark Maurer, the executive director of the Sentencing Project and author of Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences. He joins us to discuss how Manafort's light sentence might bring a needed focus to the disparity between the sentencing of rich white men compared to poor minority offenders, but with sentences in the US so extremely harsh, perhaps we can also look at most advanced countries where you would have to kill somebody to get a 20-year sentence, whereas in the US, 20-year sentences for drug crimes are handed out every day of the week. Then finally, we'll get a critique of the foreign policies put forward by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and speak with Daniel Bessner, a professor in American foreign policy at the University of Washington's Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies. He joins us to discuss his article at The Nation, Foreign Policy Beyond Good and Evil. Even Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have fallen victim to a simplistic vision of world affairs. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is James Fellows, an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. His books on media and politics include Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. And his latest book, co-authored with his wife Deborah Fellows, is Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. And he has an article at The Atlantic, Is It Time to Worry About the Boeing 737 MAX 8? Welcome to Background Briefing. James,
thank you, Ian.
So the subtitle of your article is No One Knows for Sure, but here is why experts will be looking for clues. So obviously the first clue is that this seems identical to what happened to the Lion Air crash in Indonesia. You think that's a reasonable supposition?
It seems identical, sort of. It's identical, and it's the same model of newish plane, this MAX 8 model of this Boeing 737, and the crash appeared to happen relatively soon after takeoff. But there's some other differences in the airspeed fluctuations and the descent rate, and so it's possible these are the same situation. It's possible it's something entirely different, and I think that's what all the authorities are trying to figure out now.
But the speculation with Lion Air was that there's something about the sophisticated nature of this new software in the 737 MAX 8 that essentially the pilots couldn't override, and it was sending conflicting signals that forced them to essentially stall the plane on takeoff.
So I would change that a little bit to say that the pilots didn't override, as opposed to couldn't override. So here are the things we know. First, this new model of airplane has a different placement of the engines that affects the weight and balance and the flying characteristics of the plane. Second, there is software in there that's designed to force the nose down in possible stalling configurations. And third, we know that Lion Air pilots did not override that software when it was mistakenly pushing them down. Whether they couldn't, whether they didn't know how, whether something else happens, that's not known. But yes, the software seems to have brought that plane down.
Well, that's what I meant. I mean, and that, of course, in itself is pretty alarming. They couldn't override it.
It's that they didn't override it. It's not, I mean, the question is whether they could have if they had known.
Right.
And I think that's a crucial point of difference about this, whether it was they had not been instructed on how to override it or whether they tried to and failed. That's something which of course nobody will know, but it's that's an important distinction that's not known yet.
Right. But if you're taking off and this is all happening within what, seconds of takeoff?
No, it's a couple minutes.
Couple minutes.
It's after so it wasn't just on takeoff. It's after they climbed for a while. So right. I don't recall the exact minutes in each case, but it's a matter of a couple minutes. It's right. not just in that very crucial, right. very difficult few seconds after takeoff.
Right. But still, even a couple of minutes in, it's still the plane's pretty vulnerable, right?
So it was a several thousand feet up in the case of both of these planes, where an airplane should be flyable in good conditions. And so just talking now about Lion Air, where there's obviously more known than Ethiopia, it seems now clear from all the reconstructions that the software kept mistakenly trying to make the plane go down, thinking that it was the nose up too high. The pilots kept fighting that, and the software won. In theory, they should have been able just to turn the software off. And why that didn't happen is what we don't know.
And this is the MCAS, Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, that we're talking about.
Yes, I forget the exact
right.
what all the MCS stands for. But yes, it's the MCS new software for this 737 MAX.
But doesn't that raise a huge question about where we're heading as a culture, as a society, the idea that robots are taking over?
I agree that that's an important fundamental question. I think that in general, airplanes are they're less of a clear indicator of that problem than actually autonomous cars may be. Because cars may have to make more of these split-second decisions. Do I crash head-on to the truck that's coming at me, or do I steer on the sidewalk and kill a pedestrian? There are more of those things that happen with cars than I think has been the case with airplanes. You know, it is possible that there's something really wrong with this Boeing plane, and we'll see. It's also possible these were two different accidents in what is still a statistically very safe world. So, yes, I agree that I think that autonomous cars are going to be the place where we see this played out, and probably artificial intelligence and medical care and operations and lots of things that will probably make airplanes seem comparatively tame despite the horror of this episode.
And again, I'm speaking with James Fellows, who's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. His books on media and politics include Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, and China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. And his latest book, co-authored with his wife, Deborah Fellows, is Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America. And he has an article at The Atlantic, Is It Time to Worry About the Boeing 737 MAX 8? No one knows for sure, but here is why experts will be looking for clues. Now, the big clues, I imagine, in the Lion Air would have been the black box conversation with the pilots, right? That's how we know that they were struggling to override the software.
Yes, and even more than the conversation between the pilot and first officer, which will presumably be recorded, there are measurements of at least scores, maybe more than 100 control inputs they're doing, what all the different gauges in the plane are saying, how they're moving the stick, how they're moving all the controls. So the investigators will be able to reconstruct very, very precisely what the plane was doing, what the software was doing, what the pilots were trying to do. So I think that the fact they have this data back, that's a positive sign for being able to know what actually happened.
Well, you've seen the pictures, I'm sure, James, of the crash site in Ethiopia. There's precious little left of that plane. It's just shocking how...
I mean, these are, there is, again, it's, these two things are simultaneously true, that as a statistical matter, modern airlines are very safe, but when they crash, it is just horrific, and people can imagine this circumstance, families' lives are changed forever, so it is a horrible circumstance, and if there is a design flaw, that will have major implications for the airline industry around the world. This is the 737 is the most widely used commercial airplane in the world. And, you know, the software is only on the newest model, but the 737 is every place. And so this will have big ramifications, and they need to find out soon what went on.
Well, don't Boeing have an enormous order for this model, 737?
Yes, they have a lot of orders from it's been the newest model of this MAX 8 has been popular with Chinese customers, where there's been a big order. Southwest Airlines, which flies only 737s. If you've ever been on Southwest, you've been on a 737. They have a big order, so they're just ramping up production for these new planes. They've been delivered, since I believe last year they started having some deliveries. So every day there are a whole lot of them that take off and land safely. But the fact there have been two of these planes that have crashed in the last 3 months obviously gets everyone's attention.
So there's no question that the Ethiopian crash site will yield the black boxes, right? Even though it looked so devastating, the pictures.
My understanding is that they assume they're going to get the data recorders. These black boxes are built to withstand tremendous shock and tremendous impact because they're designed to survive crashes. So I believe the evidence is that the indications are they're going to get that. I don't know that for sure, but that's what I have assumed from the coverage.
So how do pilots feel, though? You're a pilot. Your latest book with your wife, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America, James Fellows, the reason you visited all those towns on this 100,000-mile trek was that you were flying in and out of these small airfields. So you've obviously, and you're a flying buff. So have you talked to a lot of commercial aviation pilots? How do they feel that more and more the cockpit is being computerized?
I've been in the last day, today I've been spending a lot of time on aviation sites that are frequented by commercial and airline pilots. And I think there's a range of opinions, as you would think. Most people who fly planes are proud of being able to have the control themselves. For a long time, Boeing pilots were sometimes disdainful of Airbus pilots because Airbus had automated more of the controls than Boeing had. So Boeing pilots felt like they were more really like aviators of old. I think that everyone recognizes that there are functions that become safer as they are automated, from weather to certain kinds of bad weather landing approaches, which the plane can be controlled better with the autopilot. But of course, there need to be override systems if these automated controls go wrong. And that is, let me emphasize again, it's the fundamental question about both of these crashes, whether it's clear from the Lion Air crash that the software did go wrong. The question is, did the flight crew not know how to override that, or did they try and fail? And that's because if it's the latter, then that is very dangerous. If it's the former, then it's a matter of training and familiarity and all the rest. And so that is a really big question that I think is going to be on the minds of the investigators as they look at this Ethiopian crash.
But when you talk to the veteran pilots, what is the difference between the actually feeling the plane through the stick and being hands-on, and the idea that nowadays, you know, you strap yourself in, you pressure button gives you the coordinates of where you're going to land. Say you're taking off from LAX, going to Sydney, Australia, 14 hours flight. So you punch in the details, and the plane just flies itself. I mean,
well, I've never flown an airliner, so I can speak only from the perspective of a little plane where you couldn't do that.
Right. This is my understanding of how incredibly automated it is, both the navigation and even, I don't know, I imagine they hands-on when they take off and when they land, but that's becoming more and more automated too, you know.
So takeoffs, the most dangerous flight, the phase of the flight, even though passengers don't think that, is actually takeoff, because then you're close to the ground. If something failed, there's not much margin for error. So the takeoff, people do that manually just because it is so demanding and requires your entire attention. And I think that I'll make the case on both sides. The case for the erosion of basic, what they call stick and rudder skills, would be things like the Air France crash a number of years ago over the South Atlantic, where the automated indicators were failing. And similarly to, in a way, actually, it's a similar failure, but in the opposite direction of the Lion Air crash last year, where the software kept trying to move the plane's nose up, which was making it to stall when it should have been going down. And apparently the Air France flight crew was not sort of up enough on its basic stick and rudder skills to override this, to take command of the plane, and it basically they flew it into the ocean. There was another case about 15 years ago, a Colgan Air commuter plane that was flying into Buffalo, New York, where the tail got iced up and the pilot and first officer were relatively inexperienced and didn't know how to fly the plane, and it stalled too. So there is a case people can make that piloting has become too reliant on automation. The contrary case, which I actually believe, is number one, these professional flight crews are so carefully trained. If the rest of us were as conscientious about our work as most flight crews are, we would be we'd be more conscientious. They're trained all the time. They do these emergency drills, etc. And the phases of the flight that are mainly automated generally make for more safety. And I'm thinking especially of instrument approaches in bad weather. So I think the piloting community is alert to the idea that it's losing its basic skills. But they still have a lot of skill there, I would say.
Well, James Fellows, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, I'm always glad to talk to you. I'm sorry it's this somber occasion, but I'm glad to have a chance to talk with you.
Well, thanks again. And I've been speaking with James Fellows, who's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. His books on media and politics include Breaking the News, How the Media Undermine American Democracy, and China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. And his latest book, co-authored with his wife, Deborah Fellows, is Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. And he has an article at The Atlantic, Is It Time to Worry About the Boeing 737 MAX 8? No one knows for sure, but here's why experts will be looking for clues. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with one of the country's leading experts on sentencing policy, race, and the criminal justice system.
Kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I believe in on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
I met his old gal, Sadie. She said, have you seen Bill lately? I said, I don't believe that he's about. She went down to the jail. She went down to take him his mail. Then she whispered, Sheriff, please don't let him out. He's in the jailhouse now.
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 Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mark Maher, who is the Executive Director of the Sentencing Project and one of the country's leading experts on sentencing policy, race, and the criminal justice system. He has served as a consultant to the Bureau of Justice Assistance, the National Institute of Justice, and the American Bar Association's Committee on Race and the Criminal Justice System. And his books include Race to Incarcerate and Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark
Maurer. Thanks so much. Good to be here.
So do you think in a perverse way, Judge Ellis, in handing down that kid glove sentence to Paul Manafort, has forced a national debate here on disparity in sentencing between wealthy white defendants and poor minority defendants?
Well, yes, I think it's going to help to do that. And, you know, what's intriguing is that, you know, we see there are several hundred thousand felony convictions each year, and it seems like every few years we start to have this conversation when it's a high-profile person who's sentenced, then we can debate whether the sentence is too tough or too lenient, and what are the factors that go into sentencing. And meanwhile, for the vast majority of people in the system, going through what often resembles an assembly line system of justice, we don't know their names, we don't know what their backgrounds are, and we're certainly not having national debates about the severity or leniency of their sentences. So I think it just highlights just how we approach issues of crime and justice.
But that's not to say that a lot of people who don't like Trump and don't like Manafort would like to see him do more time. So it's a bit paradoxical, isn't it, in the sense that you don't want to be a critic of the system as it is, at the same time have a lust for punishment for people you don't like.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm hardly a fan of Paul Manafort or his lifestyle or business interests, but, you know, in a way, this conversation we're all having now is distorted by, you know, the American system of punishment and commitment to punishment. And, you know, for most people, the perception is 4 years, he got off pretty easy. 4 years is a long time to be in prison, to be isolated behind bars, to be separated from your family and community. You know, in other countries, the scale of punishment is much less severe than we have here. Now, that's still a different question than whether Paul Manafort got a break given the system we have, but we do want to keep that in mind, I think, that there are two questions. Did Paul Manafort get off too easy, but also conversely, are most people getting off too harshly, certainly compared to other industrialized nations?
So is there a debate then to be had in conjunction with this election cycle, you know, which unfortunately will go on until November of 2020. It's just beginning. There's an interesting article in the New York Times by James Forman Jr., law professor at Yale, titled "The Democratic Candidate Should Tell Us Now Who They'll Put on the Supreme Court." And this is an article basically making the case that in order to deal with the crisis of mass incarceration in this country, that the Democrats should bring it into the election, bring it into the debate, and have candidates running for president who should do what Trump did, which was say who they're going to put on the Supreme Court. Because, as the article points out, 43% of federal judges have been prosecutors, while only 10% have been public defenders. So that is a place to start, isn't it, at the Supreme Court?
Yeah. Well, I'm not one to offer advice to the Democratic Party, but Professor Forman lays out a very critical issue, and that is, you know, we may debate sometimes a particular sentence a judge gives out or a particular law that Congress may implement, but the federal courts, you know, have enormous power over what our system of justice looks like. The courts have done some wonderful things. The Gideon decision going back more than half century about the right to have counsel with you at your trial, many other protections, you know, for criminal defendants against the power of the state. But the courts can also be quite vindictive, very harsh in their interpretations of constitutional law. Not too many years ago, the Supreme Court upheld the California three strikes and you're out policy, which at the time any third strike could be any felony in the state of California. And the question was it cruel and unusual for someone who stole three golf clubs to get 25 to life in prison? And the court turned down that argument, saying that was best left to the legislature in California to decide that. So So, yes, the federal judiciary has an enormous role to play. You know, any good citizen should be paying attention to that, what the qualifications are, who these people are, their perspective on the law in the 21st century and what that means.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Maurer, who's Executive Director of the Sentencing Project and one of the country's leading experts on sentencing policy, race, and the criminal justice system. He has served as a consultant to the Bureau of Justice Assistance, the National Institute of Justice, and the American Bar Association's Committee on Race and the Criminal Justice System. And his books include Race to Incarcerate and Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences. But on the flip side of what you just said, Mark, it does seem that since the federal judiciary is so stacked with former prosecutors, and I assume that is also the case throughout the states as well, where judges are 43% in the federal system are former prosecutors, while only 10% are former public defenders, that disparity surely has led to some of the major decisions coming out of the Supreme Court, which has held that the Fourth Amendment doesn't prohibit police from racially profiling drivers during traffic stops, that the Sixth Amendment permits trials with underfunded defense lawyers who present little evidence or argument, and that the Eighth Amendment is no bar to outrageous sentences like life without parole for possession of a few marijuana joints.
Well, you know, there's no question that there are many very decent prosecutors who approach their jobs with thoughtfulness and believe they're being very objective in how they look at the issues. But the institution of the prosecutor, the power of the prosecutors, has been very significant in shaping criminal justice policy. You know, as we look at reforms that are being proposed at the state level, there are many instances where there's a virtual consensus among policymakers to scale back the use of mandatory sentencing, divert more people into treatment programs, and prosecutors in a number of states have been the main holdout, and they've been very influential in that. So when we think about that kind of background, that kind of approach, yes, you know, prosecutors have the right to be appointed as federal judges, but if we want to get a diversity and a range of opinion, we probably don't want that high proportion of former prosecutors, because that will almost inevitably skew the perspective that's being offered up there.
Well, in the we talked a little bit earlier about the Democratic race, and obviously you don't want to comment on it, but it just happens that two of Democrats running, Senator Kamala Harris and Amy Klobuchar, are both former prosecutors, and they've been fending off criticism and questions about their former work, along with Vice President Joe Biden, who's about to enter the race. And, of course, he's probably going to be questioned about his crime legislation in the 1980s and 1990s. So is there a study done in terms of, and it may be out of your wheelhouse, but is there a sociological American explanation for why we are the number one country in the world per capita in terms of incarceration? Is there some national characteristic that has a lust for punishment?
Yeah, well, there are a variety of theories about how this came about. You know, some people trace it to, you know, the basically individualistic nature of American society and the pioneer spirit, and that, you know, we're all responsible to determine our own outcomes and sort of foregrounding the individual and very much putting the state or community very much behind that, whereas much of Western Europe is more of a social welfare orientation, and certainly you know, more support for individuals who are in trouble and ailing, and more consideration of societal factors that may contribute to incarceration. There are other structural considerations people have looked at. In some countries like Germany, the criminal justice professionals are viewed as professionals and given the charge to administer the justice system. So it means that if you look among judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, it's not unusual for them to be rotating positions from time to time. A prosecutor may become a judge, or a defense attorney may become a prosecutor, and they're viewed as professionals with skills in that area, and it somewhat isolates the system from political pressures. You know, we have tough on crime policies, primarily because of the actors in the system, but it's been politically inspired over several decades, the generations of mandatory sentencing and the war on drugs, and then the actors in the courtrooms are the ones who implement those policies. And not that they don't have choices themselves, but it's a broader problem than just what goes on inside the courtroom.
Well, Mark Maurer, you quoted recently in the New York Times saying that a lot of countries, you'd have to kill somebody to get anywhere close to the 20-year sentence, yet we hand out 20-year sentences for drug crimes every day of the week.
Yeah, no, and it's very sad, and that's all about the scale of punishment. You know, my new book, you mentioned The Meaning of Life. We document that one of every seven people in prison today, 200,000, are serving a life sentence. Now, yes, they've committed serious crimes for the most part, but there are serious crimes in other nations as well. They don't use these decades-long sentences nearly to the extent that we do here. And I would add, you know, there's no evidence to suggest that life imprisonment somehow brings greater public safety. In fact, it brings diminishing returns, as we have people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s who are little risk to public safety locked up in our prison system at, you know, escalating costs each year. It's a very counterproductive approach we've taken.
So let's talk a bit then, Mark Maurer, about the sentencing guidelines and how they're contributing to the situation that we're talking about here and what can be done to reverse it.
Yeah. Well, in the federal system, 1987, a system of sentencing guidelines was put into place, which is basically a system where the judge is obligated to look at the crime of conviction and your prior criminal history, and there's a grid, and those two factors tell the judge where within the sentencing structure you fall on that grid, and the judge is supposed to impose a sentence in that grid. In 2005, there was a Supreme Court case called Booker, which found that system unconstitutional and essentially made the guideline system advisory. So now federal judges are obligated to consult the guidelines, but they're granted the discretion to sentence as they feel appropriate. They can go above the guidelines, below the guidelines, and it's given them the authority. And many federal judges and others had been very concerned about the original guidelines, which were exceedingly rigid and exceedingly punitive. You know, you could have someone who came to court with a long-term history of substance abuse or sexual assault, victimization, a variety of issues like that, or a single mom with two kids who would be put in foster care if she was incarcerated, and by and large, judges were prohibited from taking into account any of those factors in determining a sentence. So now I think it's a good development that judges can use discretion to look at the entirety of the individual and the crime. It does mean that different judges are going to come out in different places on particular cases, and sometimes we may think that's going too far, and sometimes that's just different perspectives on what kind of justice is appropriate.
And that, of course, certainly is the case with Judge Ellis's saying that Paul Manafort had led an otherwise blameless life. Of course, there's another judge who will be sentencing him sometime this week in the D.C. Mm-hmm. Circuit Court. We'll see what happens there. But what can we do about Congress's role in mandatory sentencing?
Well, that's really the focal point for what needs to be done. You know, the sentencing guideline system, whether one likes it or not, it was a system that was proportional based on these various factors. And then on top of that, Congress proceeded to adopt a range of mandatory sentencing policies, many of them implemented for federal drug offenses that essentially trumped the guidelines in many of those cases. And, you know, at the extremes, it led to the sentencing policies. On your third federal drug conviction, you would get a sentence of life without parole, for third-time drug offense. Now, we've had some modest reform recently with the First Step Act legislation that just passed in Congress in December. So it takes, for example, that three-time drug crime, reduces it from life without parole to a minimum of 25 years in prison. And again, 25 years for a drug offense is virtually unheard of in comparable nations. So it's progress, but, you know, we really need to get rid of mandatory sentencing across the board. It's nothing but a system of one size fits all, and, you know, any judge in the country, whether appointed by Democrats or Republicans, will tell you that no two individuals, no two crimes are exactly alike. That's why we need a judge in the courtroom, not a legislative body requiring what the sentence is, merely determined by the quantity of drugs in the crime itself.
Well, just in closing, is there any educational process underway to change the minds of the voters who vote for politicians who promise to punish people, as opposed to having them vote for politicians who say, look, we're wasting an awful lot of money on warehousing people well into their elderly years and who are completely harmless, and it's just led to this, the creation of what is referred to as the prison industrial complex, etc. I mean, there are some good arguments. You just made some of them. Yeah. Is there any way to get them out there in a way that will resonate?
Well, I think they have been getting out there. You know, increasing numbers of Americans are now very critical of the war on drugs, and they recognize the excesses of it, and they very supportive of treatment rather than incarceration. You know, you mentioned the current presidential campaign. I think what's intriguing is that we have at least several of the Democratic participants now, Senator Booker, Senator Harris, among others, who a major part of their campaign is a challenge to mass incarceration. And, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, there's no way that would have happened, even among the most liberal candidates who might have been running in primaries. And I think that does reflect a shift in the American political environment, culture. You know, we've had the Black Lives Matter movement. We've had concerns about loss of voting rights for people with felony convictions. And there's growing public support for a reversal of the policies that created mass incarceration. So I think political leaders are now responding to that new environment. You know, the challenge is both at the grassroots level and in the halls of Congress to keep up that drumbeat for a different approach to how we calculate public safety objectives.
Well, Mark Maurer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Maurer, who's Executive Director of the Sentencing Project and one of the country's leading experts on sentencing policy, race, and the criminal justice system. He has served as a consultant to the Bureau of Justice Assistance, the National Institute of Justice, and the American Bar Association's Committee on Race and the Criminal Justice System. And his books include Race to Incarcerate and Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences. We're going to take a brief station break and back with a critique of the foreign policies put forward by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
Conscience, now guilt is a concept, you know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Daniel Bessner, who's a professor of American foreign policy at the University of Washington's Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies and the author of Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier, and The Rise of the Defense Intellectual. He has an article at The Nation, Foreign Policy Beyond Good and Evil. Even Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have fallen victims to a simplistic vision of world affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Bessner.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Daniel, I have a theory, and I was actually going to run it by Bernie, who I know, and that is that I believe the sweet spot for a Democratic politician, and particularly one running for president, is to be an idealist on domestic issues and a realist on foreign policy. And I pick up from your article that you're not entirely sure that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren and others are realists on foreign policy. But at the same time, I assume you're not calling for a return to the realpolitik of Henry Kissinger?
No, of course, not at all. Basically, the difficulty is that foreign policy pronouncements and speeches are often very different from what people will actually do in office. So in a sense, this is less a critique of a particular policy approach that Bernie or Elizabeth Warren might have, and more just a criticism of how they are using what my and my co-author Udi Greenberg believe to be frameworks of a Manichaean frameworks for understanding international relations that uncomfortably echo this dichotomous division of world politics that occurred throughout the Cold War in American history. So I'm very much not calling for a return to the sort of amoral politics of a Henry Kissinger, but I'm also I do think it's important that the American policymakers, particularly on the left, don't portray a simplistic world where the United States is on the side of the good and everyone else is on the side of the evil, while also appreciating that we should be working together to fight the oligarchic kleptocrats like Putin and like Orban. So it's a very subtle argument that I'm making that it's I think, important to discuss.
So in terms of the critique of Sanders, who recently in his foreign policy address said the world is presently locked in a struggle between a movement towards authoritarianism, oligarchy, and kleptocracy, and a movement committed to strengthening democracy, egalitarianism, and social and economic, social, racial, and environmental justice. And he's calling for a coalition to combat the rise of the new authoritarian axis led by Russia's Vladimir Putin, Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro, Hungary's Viktor Orban, and other right-wing dictators. So what's wrong with that?
Well, I think, first of all, I agree with a lot of the sentiment behind the statement that there are a lot of kleptocrats running around the world doing a lot of untold damage. The problem is that I think when you're talking to the American public, you have to be very wary about not framing the United States as good and not framing the rest of the world as evil, because progressive politics, at least in my opinion, should be undergirded by a humanistic impulse that is difficult to reach if one frames these countries as almost invariably evil and on the side of evil. It's a very slippery and easy slope, I think, between that sort of framing and what's going on in MSNBC right now, where Vladimir Putin is the instantiation of all evil and progressives are cheering basically a new Cold War with Russia or a new Cold War with China or people. I mean, not really progressives, but liberals. So I think one needs to be very careful about how one frames international politics, where, of course, I agree with Bernie that the United States does need to be part of coalitions that combat these sorts of groups. But at the same time, I think this needs to be done without adopting a too simplistic Manichaean division of world affairs that essentially says U.S. is good and these various countries are evil, even if there is a lot of evil in the leaders of these countries themselves. It very, very quickly goes into xenophobia and these types of permanent wars that have characterized U.S. international relations since World War II.
Well, but, you know, my criticism of people like Oliver Stone, who did that Valentine to Putin, long three-part interviews in Showtime, my sense is that the American left should be, you know, not making excuses for despots, but trying to reach out to the very people that are being oppressed by these despots. Like, for example, the young Russians who bravely take to the street. They did the other day, 10,000 plus took to the streets because Putin's trying to close down the internet, the last avenue of free speech. They're the people we have to be in solidarity with. So how, to my mind, you know, the political left in this country used to be the conscience of our foreign policy against the dictators that we cozied up with during the Cold War, against the Somoza regime, against the murderous generals down in El Salvador. But now I get a lot of hate mail complaining that I'm covering Venezuela in a way that they don't like, because they, for some reason or other, a lot of people are invested in Maduro, who's, you know, I can't see the difference between a corrupt capitalist and a corrupt socialist, frankly. And this guy's wrecked this country. And because he's being opposed by Trump, Bolton, Elliot Abrahams, and Senator Marco Rubio, the assumption is that, you know, because those people we don't like, therefore Maduro's got to be okay and a victim.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the left never does well for itself when it apologizes for dictators who have done a lot of awful things, but particularly during the Cold War with Castro or people who for a time apologized for Stalin. I think that's never in the left's medium or long-term interest, while also recognizing that these are complex situations, and that doesn't necessarily mean that the United States should militarily intervene to overthrow Maduro. I think we have to have a subtlety to our international thought that we often don't have. But the issue is, I think what you said before about we need to be engaging with young Russians, I think that's a bit of a complex issue, because yes, we do need to do that. I'm not necessarily sure that you want to do that with the American states, because once you start giving the executive more power, let's say when someone else bad is in power, like Trump is, or whomever Mitt Romney is going forward, that gives the executive more power to do things. So I think we on the left need to be much more conscious and coherent about developing a foreign policy organized around civil society organizations. So to take Venezuela, ideally, we would have had decades of NGO and labor union connections to Venezuela so that we could actually have a knowledge of what the Venezuelan people want to help them through the various resources that the United States has. But I would like this to be done at a sub-state and not necessarily a state level. But at the same time, while we do want to support the young Russians, we also do need to recognize that a lot of the problems of the global commons, for example, in my opinion, climate change being the most important one, will require dealing with people like Putin. And we can't just ignore that. And we can't just use the moralism of the United States to say that we're not going to deal with Putin, or we're not going to deal with all these people who necessarily we need to deal with if we want to solve global problems like climate change. The world, I think that the way we put it in the article, democratic socialists do not create the world in which we live. And we've learned that time and again over the course of American history that military intervention also doesn't create the world in which we want to live. So in some sense, we have to deal with the world as it is. And as it is, we do need to deal diplomatically with people like Putin.
Well, how would you deal, though, with Bernie Sanders' objective that he offered up in his speech in October at Johns Hopkins University, where he said the United States must lead an international movement dedicated to increasing the power of labor and combating the catastrophic effects of climate change? You just mentioned that we should have NGOs more involved and labor unions, et cetera, more connected to international brothers and sisters.
I think that's great. I mean, the problem is when he it's this dichotomous Manichaean division. That goal, I completely agree with that. But the problem is the international framing, because I think that we've shown throughout the course of 20th century history that dichotomous framing often leads to awful events as occurred throughout the Cold War. All the dictators you mentioned, the overthrow of Mossadegh in 53, the overthrow of Arbenz in 84, whatever U.S. participation, the Chilean coup of 73, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we need to be able to talk to the public, by we being progressive leaders, we need to be able to talk to the public and understand and help them understand that international relations is a very complex realm in which the ethics of domestic politics do matter, but they also matter in relation to other ethics as well, which might be termed more realist ethics. Otherwise, I think we're not going to be able to solve these enormous problems of the global commons. And I think Bernie, I don't think he would disagree with that. I think his general foreign policy thrust is to make the United States basically a beacon to the world by having a more just United States. I think that is his major interest, and that's something that I agree with. But I also think that he really does have to be careful not to inadvertently, and I don't think he means to do this, I think very much not, to inadvertently reproduce his very Manichaean understanding of international relations that has done so much damage in the past.
So in terms of the foreign policy pledge, issued by this veterans group Common Defense that called for an end of global destabilizing, ever-expanding, endless wars that have cost the blood, lives, and dollars of millions of people around the world. Is that something that, in your article, you mentioned that both Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Representatives Ro Khanna, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib have also signed onto this pledge? What's wrong with that? The pledge itself.
Nothing. There's nothing wrong with that. That pledge is great.
Yeah.
I'm literally not criticizing any of that whatsoever. It's the framing of international relations. That's the problem. That pledge is great. I support it 100%. Also, as you know, journals give articles certain titles that it meant to drive clicks. I think if people actually read the piece, they'll see it's not a criticism of any of those policies in any way whatsoever, which is everything that I endorse. It's only a criticism of sort of the simplistic division of the world into good and evil, which I think is a way that Americans have understood foreign policy for a very long time. And I think we as progressives need to be careful not to, and again, inadvertently reproduce that Manichaean division.
Well, I mean, I would venture criticism of Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, even though it's unfashionable, because I think they've really derailed the House agenda via their remarks, particularly on H.R. 1, which I think is one of the most important bills ever put forth to the Senate. Everybody's dismissing it, saying, well, it doesn't have a chance in this because of the Republicans in the Senate. Well, that's not the point. This is something that people should be discussing. This is a way to fix American politics. The Green New Deal is getting an awful lot more attention, but it's aspirational, whereas H.R. 1 is actually a fundamental document prepared by the House of Representatives. It could be a blueprint for change.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the Omar case, which is the one I'm more familiar with, I think it's done a lot of good, though, in terms of changing the Overton window and talking about Israel-Palestine. And it's also good that she forced a sort of reckoning on the political left about what are they going to not condemn. And I think it's a big move that they eventually decided to scuttle the resolution about anti-Semitism and make it this sort of general resolution about hate, about hate generally, because it just shows that the conversation is changing, right? And I think it's really important to do those types of things. And also, you know, the Democratic House Caucus is a large body, and I'm reticent to blame the newest members, many of whom are women of color, for derailing an agenda, because I think they're getting undue attention paid to them for a variety of structural reasons that are evident that permeate the American polity and particularly the American media class.
No, well, I wouldn't want to be on the side of their critics who basically want a vision of the Middle East, particularly the Israel-Palestinian issues, as, you know, you've got to accept Netanyahu's vision, which is it's my way or the highway. And that is essentially what's being imposed on us through these, you know, BDS restrictions happening at the state level. Those are much more scary and undemocratic and against the First Amendment than anything that these two young, inexperienced congresspeople have said. But she did, Omar did say that it was critical of Obama, saying he's a pretty face behind which he did some horrible things like drone attacks.
Right.
So she's right.
100%.
She's right.
100% right. And it's fantastic that a Democratic representative is saying that.
Right. No,
otherwise, I think, you know, never would have happened. So I think Omar, in basically 2 weeks, has almost totally changed the discussion totally changed the norm on two issues. One, Israel-Palestine, and two, like Obama's legacy, Obama's responsibility for a lot of the horrors we see today.
Right. And if she's successful in changing the terms of the debate about Israel-Palestine, then she'd be doing us all a favor, because it really has been totally one-sided. So I don't have a problem with any of that. But I do have a problem with the inability of people to have two contradictory thoughts in their head at the same time. For example, it is possible that a hero on the left, Edward Snowden, he could be both a hero and a traitor. I mean, it's possible to be two contradictory things at the same time.
Which is what I'm saying right now. Also, like, I agree with Bernie, and I actually agree with his diagnosis of the international situation. But I also think that we need to be careful, again, not to reproduce these Manichaean understandings of international politics.
And that in terms of the Venezuelan issue, it's true that the people on our side pushing a reckless policy, which is using foreign aid as a weapon, and may well provoke a civil war. The fact that there are people that I personally can't stand, like Donald Trump, John Bolton, Elliot Abrahams, and Senator Marco Rubio, pushing this reckless policy on the one hand. But on the other hand, you know, I also recognize who Maduro is and how somebody that has destroyed a country with the biggest oil reserves in the world has to be held to account. So again, you can be against Maduro and against Trump at the same time.
Yeah, no, of course. And again, I think what's important to highlight here is that it's kind of a perverse situation where Americans feel the need to pontificate about every world leader in every situation that just, you know, is a reflection of this imperial presence that we hold in the world. Right. So maybe we also need to reconsider the assumption that America needs to, quote unquote, do something all the time. I think that would be, you know, a good place to start in rethinking American foreign policy and reformulating a lot of our assumptions.
So in terms of, I remember years ago having an interesting conversation with Paul Nitze, who was a very important foreign policy guru. And I was talking about the Cold War and along the lines of what we're talking about, you know, us supporting all these horrible people and losing our moral standing. That, and I, you know, I said, look, at the end of the day, rock and roll brought down the Berlin Wall. It was soft power, you know, not the number of missiles.
I thought it was David Hasselhoff.
Maybe it was David Hasselhoff, yeah. But yeah. In any case, it wasn't necessarily all of the nuclear weapons and missiles we're pointing at them. And he said an interesting thing. He said, well, you know, there was an attempt by some foreign policy people in the State Department and in the intelligence world to come up with a geopolitical theory of geopolitical indigestion. In other words, the theory being let the Russians take over more and more of Africa and the rest of the world because that will just accelerate the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, they're moving into the Horn of Africa and Angola, et cetera, and our side was hysterical. And we ended up backing the South African apartheid horrors.
Yeah.
Great
move.
yeah. So, but that theory of geopolitical indigestion didn't get anywhere because we are too Manichaean, and the Defense Department is not subtle. They want money and power, and the rest is history, you know, that we simply have a system that needs an enemy. So is that a fundamental problem, that we really are essentially on a permanent war economy that needs an enemy, even if it's a fictitious enemy?
Well, I think that's a totally correct reading of American history, is that a lot of social progress has been pursued, particularly through military Keynesianism. And also, for example, the integration of the military in the late 1940s or Truman's attempt to do that were, you know, key drivers of social and economic progress, which often, as many people have shown, have had racialized and gendered exclusions. But the question is, you know, does it need to be this way? And I certainly don't think it needs to be this way. Humans create their own histories. We create our own world. And I think we need to start thinking beyond the Cold War, is the way that I would put it, thinking beyond the empire. And in some sense, I don't fault Bernie or Elizabeth Warren for talking in these types of dichotomous terms, because it's the entire world in which they grew up and were divided according to these spaces. And there is, I should add, a political utility to being able to identify an enemy. That is something important to do. But I just worry that sort of division encourages, even if not intentionally, encourages militarism, encourages interventionism, and encourages Americans to feel like they're less safe in the world than they actually are. So I would just tell, if I were talking to Bernie directly, who I very much support and who will vote for and will canvass for, etc., I would just tell him to keep to his plans, but to alter the message in such a way where it doesn't have this dichotomous Manichaean understanding of international affairs.
Daniel Bessner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Bessner, a professor of American foreign policy at the University of Washington, Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies, and the author of Democracy in Exile, Hand Spire, and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual. And he has an article at The Nation, Foreign Policy Beyond Good and Evil. Even Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have fallen victim to a simplistic vision of world affairs. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.